Welcome to the Glasgow Southern Medical Society. On Boxing Day 2004, a tsunami struck the coastal regions of Southeast Asia, causing devastation and the deaths of a quarter of a million people. In this programme, we hear how Glasgow GP Dr. David Willocks was drawn from his fireside chair and found himself in southwest Sri Lanka with a team of volunteers from the Glasgow-based charity Glasgow, the Caring City. First, we join members of the Society to hear a welcome from the President, Dr. Philip Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second meeting of the 161st session of the Society, and it's nice to see a good turnout again tonight. The Society's growing, or so it appears. First, apologies. Do we have any apologies?
David Kidd.
Just one? Okay. The minutes of the last meeting are, for the first time, not only available in the minute book, but also on the Society's wonderful website, which I hope some of you have visited. You can get the web address from myself or Jonathan Oates after the meeting if you haven't visited it yet. This website is from now having audio files as well as slide files of the speakers that we have through the year. So you can listen as many times as you like to this evening's lecture. And we have Dr. Jonathan Oates to thank for setting up the website, which really is tremendously good in my view. Can we take the minutes of the last meeting as read? Sorry? And listen to, yes. Now, it's my pleasure to be able to present a cup to Dr. Ewing Forrester. Those of you that were at the dinner will know that I know absolutely nothing about golf whatsoever. And I asked many attenders at the Society's dinner what a bogey competition was, and nobody could give me a sensible answer. So to the winner of this incomprehensible competition, Dr. Ewing Forrester, I'd like to present the Christie Cup. The next meeting of the Society is a joint meeting with the Medico-Chirurgical Society of Royal Medico-Chirurgical Society of Glasgow, and that's to be held on Thursday, the 12th of January, at 7:30, at the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Glasgow. And the talk will be Professor Alan Silman, who's the director of the ARC Epidemiology Unit in Manchester, and the talk's entitled "Clinical Trials: Do They Always Give the Right Answer?" So that's 7:30 on Thursday, the 12th of January, at the college. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Dr. David Willocks, a friend and colleague over many years, a great trainer and educator of young doctors in the west of Scotland and beyond. And he's going to tell us tonight about work that he was involved in following the tsunami in Sri Lanka earlier this year. He became involved in this work through his wife working for the Healthy Cities, Glasgow Caring City charity, which received a great deal of media coverage and support. So, David, if you'd like to tell us about your experiences. Thank you.
Good evening. It's really lovely to be here and see so many friendly faces. I must admit, when I was asked to come along, I thought, you know, it's only a couple of years since my presidential address to the Society. And I was really touched that you should want to hear me again. Sadly, I think it may be, in, from your point of view, a little bit of a triumph of hope over actually experience. But nevertheless, I do hope that you will enjoy what I have to say tonight. Phil's right. I in fact, on the 26th of December, started driving a wee white van around because Morag, my wife, has been involved in the Caring City charity for a while, and I thought I can go and pick up some bin bags, and it beats sitting in front of the telly. And before I knew it, what happened was I was asked to act as the medical officer for the charity because we started receiving a lot of medical aid and it had to be sifted. And before I knew it, the next thing that was happening was we were planning a visit to try to decide what we would do as a charity in Sri Lanka. And what I really want to do tonight is to begin to give you a little bit of a lowdown on what we found and perhaps just present an idea, maybe a few word pictures for you of Sri Lanka, the people, the place, and perhaps some of the projects that we got involved with, in perhaps no particular order, but hopefully in one that you will enjoy and appreciate. If you had been in Sri Lanka on Christmas Day last year, as many Westerners were, you would have found really quite a beautiful country, both in terms of its geography and in terms of the people who lived and worked in the area. And as the sun set on Christmas Day, it would have seemed that you had discovered a piece of paradise that had probably been there forever, the warm Indian Ocean lapping at the beaches, just absolutely the most beautiful place on earth. Sadly, the following day, in came the wave, and the tsunami, as we all know, killed a great number of people in the Southeast Asia area, probably around 250,000, and about 40,000 deaths in Sri Lanka, with over 500,000 people being dislocated by the tsunami, put out of their homes and living in temporary camps. Now, we visited an area that had been hit by the wave, and the wave looks, from this sort of picture, as a fairly powerful thing, somewhat of a maelstrom behind it, but if you happen to be sort of in front of it, I don't suppose it's a very pleasant thing at all. This actually, I believe, was taken in Thailand, and I'm told that everyone you see in the picture had survived the wave, but it certainly looks like they had quite a battle to get out of that. And of course, the same thing hit Sri Lanka. Brian here, one of the charity members, is indicating with his hand where the water level settled in one of the villages after the wave. And you can see a series of lines down the wall as it would have gradually dissipated. And when you see those sorts of pictures, you start to get a feel for precisely what sort of problems the villagers must have had to face. And of course, the other thing the wave did was it created a huge amount of destruction in terms of wildlife. And when you see this number of fish killed, you begin to start to realise that there must be more than fish who are going to die. What you see all along the coast was all the fishermen in Sri Lanka live right on the coast. They live in their houses and villages. They push their boats out off the beach and they come back to their coastal houses and villages right along the coastal strip. And there was widespread devastation. Large, well-built brick and concrete buildings had been devastated. Beaches were turned into quagmires and whole areas were destroyed. Of course, it wasn't just physical destruction. Everywhere in a land where the temperatures, one of the days we were there, the temperature was 42 degrees. It was incredibly humid. We were there in basically the dry season in early March, as monsoon was just thinking about coming probably a month or two later. And even then, the sheer number of people killed was extensive. We visited an area loosely known as Hikkaduwa, which consists of around about 100 villages and about 100,000 people. And there were at least 6,000 deaths in that area. And everywhere that you went, you would be able to see the piled up destruction. Palm trees seem to be very much spared by wave, and I must admit, I would have thought if you ever find yourself in an area where there's going to be one of these things, getting up a palm tree seems like a clever idea if you can manage it, although having watched the locals do it, it's definitely an acquired skill. As you see, this is taken in Galle, I believe, one of the major towns in southern Sri Lanka, and you can see that the destructive power of this and the debris afterwards is near on overwhelming. This is the Galle cricket ground. And I'm an avid cricket fan, and I must admit I have watched and listened to the English cricket team, who are effectively the British cricket team for any Scots who are feeling a bit nationalistic. But I've listened to the English cricket team playing in Gaul, and it was a strange feeling to go and watch this sort of sight where the place has been completely and utterly destroyed. And of course, the bits of debris that you see lying around, in fact, aren't debris. They are people who have lost their lives, and everywhere there was terrible destruction. It sadly also didn't simply affect adults, and as you see here, in what appears to have been a building that has more or less survived, nevertheless, a large number of people have lost their lives. This is one of the first people I'd like to tell you about tonight, and the person I'd like to talk to you about is the person on the extreme right here, and his name is Dr. Clifford Pereira. Cliff's a forensic scientist. He's the only forensic pathologist in Gaul in Sri Lanka, and he went to bed on the 25th of December and woke up the following day with 6,500 bodies to manage. Some of the people that you see here in his team are volunteers, some of them from Leicester. Cliff was talking to me when I was out, and he said that one of the Leicester chaps had said to him that in the UK, if they had to manage a disaster of 200 people in over the course of even 2 weeks, he said that that would probably overwhelm them in any one area in the UK. And Cliff had 6,500 bodies to deal with regards to his team. He's a remarkable man. He's a lovely man. He trained, in fact, in Glasgow, I'm told, for some of his training. I don't know if anyone will remember him from that time. I haven't managed to pin him down to precisely where he was. But he's a remarkably positive guy and has survived and has coped superbly with what's been happening. We were very fortunate to be able to help him in a small way with some donations towards IT, and also we were able to help him get to a conference in Thailand on disaster victim identification and management after the tsunami. But Cliff's team faced a great number of problems. You can see that there's some fairly disinterested and almost hostile faces looking at the camera. This was taken around the time of tsunami. These are not my pictures. And I can imagine the sorts of things they're having to cope with and the way they're feeling about it, and the 40 degree heat's probably not helping either, and life is not a particularly pleasant one. Here you see them doing some basic archaeology at the bottom of a pit, and somewhere down in the middle of that they're in fact unearthing a body. They're all gowned and masked, because as you can imagine, this is not as we are having it, without the benefit of smelly vision. This would be a really gruesome and unpleasant task. This picture wall made me think of the 9/11 tragedy in New York. I remember the 9/11 tragedy in New York, when the everywhere along the boulevards in New York you saw countless pictures of missing people, and there were all these pictures that loved ones had put up of their friends and husbands and wives, and they were all pictures of living people. This is, in fact, Cliff's death wall, and all these people are dead bodies. And the sad and gruesome fact is that relatives are coming in and they're having to look at the dead bodies and identify their relatives. And as you see, this poor man has found what none of us would like to find in such a situation. But to have to look at all these bodies in death for people who perhaps are not used to it can't have been a pleasant task, particularly as they were so traumatised. Behind you, in the background in this picture, we see a huge pit where the bodies are being buried. And the truth of the matter is that large numbers were buried in mass graves. And Cliff's task has been, over the months that followed, to gradually unearth these mass graves and begin the task of identification. Because it's not just... part of his job has been about identifying foreigners, and any that he did, he tended to ship to Colombo, the capital. But nevertheless, it's still been important in Sri Lankan terms to be able to identify as many people as possible. And as you see, this father possibly here has the gruesome task of taking his daughter to the pit. This is a piece of art which I thought quite neatly summed up the way we found the children in Sri Lanka. And when we were there, we found that they were beginning to recover. And this is something that this belongs to someone I'll speak about later, a nurse called Alison Thompson. She's been working a lot and has a great following of the children. And they're encouraging them both to draw and also to write about their experiences. And it seems quite a poignant but sad little poster. It's certainly a very unfortunate thing, I imagine, in her life. This shows, just looking over in the background towards one of the mass graves, and another problem that occurred, and that is that this is a team of scientists from Interpol who arrived, dug up a mass grave, chucked the bodies around, took away a couple of foreigners, and then chucked the bodies back in and buried them again. And that, according to the people who were there, was quite a distressing thing for everyone concerned. But it shows you the sorts of things that go on in the aftermath of these disasters as people start to try to get a handle on what's going on and try to begin to get back to whatever might be called normality. I'd like to tell you the story of the train at Paralia. Paralia is at the top end of the area that we visited in Hikkaduwa, and the train was the Gall Colombo train, consisting of around 12 carriages, and it was on its way to Colombo when the first wave went through. It's probably important to explain that the tsunami consisted of probably two fairly major waves on the southern eastern coast of Sri Lanka. And the first wave went through, and as far as I understand, sort of partially it stopped the train and perhaps partially derailed it. And the people who were there recognised, they could see that the sea had gone out a long way, and they knew that there was a likelihood of a second wave. And so what they did was, they did what anyone would do, is they looked for the safest place that they could go to. And what they did was, most of them put their children on the train. The next wave came through, and the next couple of pictures give you some idea of what happened to the train. There are bodies lying around, there's water, and the whole place was really destroyed. This constitutes the world's greatest ever train disaster, as far as I'm aware. The story I have heard is that the death toll was 1,500. Now, that's said to be the official death toll. The locals that I spoke to or have heard of have said that it took almost 10 days for the government to arrive with sufficient people or lifting gear to be able to make any difference, and that in the early stages, and to count the bodies, if you like, but in the early stages, the bereaved parents did what any bereaved parent would do. They took their child or children and buried them, so that the number of bodies that were eventually counted, in fact, were far fewer than the number who probably died. The other thing that's said to have happened was that the world's press and media arrived after about 3 days and began taking a lot of pictures of this area. But at that stage, there were still people trapped in the wreckage and they were still dying. And local Buddhists, for a few more days, poured water in to people they couldn't reach, but they all sadly died. And the government arrived 10 days later and mopped up. I don't think we can necessarily blame any governments. A number of people have spoken tonight about the fact that we're aware that our Foreign Office is being criticised for its response to the tsunami in a number of areas. But I think this was such an incredible disaster that no one had any real possibility of anticipating it. And I think that the government would have been frozen by the sheer enormity of it. Three of the carriages were brought back because when the carriages were all cleared, the locals became very distressed, and they stay there as a permanent memorial. And as you see, the locals live very close to the tracks there in a temporary shelter. There have been a number of sort of famous people who have wandered past the trains. This is Muralitharan, which I'm glad to have managed to pronounce, and another of the Sri Lankan cricketers who played a special match and raised money, and there are other less Sri Lankan individuals, Beefy Botham, still looking very beefy, and Shane Warne on the left, and the guy he's with is a guy called Donny, who I was never privileged enough to meet, but all the stories that I've heard of this man are tremendous. He basically just turned up, and if there was a roof that needed fixing, if there was a house that needed building, If there was a trench that needed dug, Donnie was your man, as far as I'm aware, and is one of the definite heroes of the place. The people who arrive after disasters are remarkable people. They're usually drawn there for an indeterminate reason, and they usually, the ones that stay, are capable of simply rolling up their sleeves and just getting on with it. And he's one of the great heroes of the place. Looking back at the train here, you'll see a number of wooden shelters, and this is another. There are a number of bits of if you like, good charity work. There's a number of bits of bad or charity work that doesn't necessarily go so well. And this is one here. This is an example. There were a number of the huge, big charities. The DEC charity's got £300 million and Save the Children, Salvation Army, Oxfam. And they were all out there and they were pitching with government to try and get things done. But the trouble was that the Sri Lankan government was stymied and couldn't decide and couldn't make up their minds how to progress. So there were very few buildings being built, and the monsoon was coming, and people were living in inadequate accommodation. This is one example of relatively poor building, because all of these huts are all together in a long line. And inside, what happens is that the people just simply, they have open fires inside on which they cook. They have very little possessions, and one of the problems is that's the line of huts after it all went on fire. One of them goes on fire and they all just go on fire. So the idea is for single huts, and you can be very well-meaning in a charitable way. This is a minor example, but there's no one who has ever tried to do anything in a charitable way who hasn't realised that there are a million ways of getting it wrong, but it's still worth trying. But that's certainly one of them. The other things that can be done, of course, are to build new houses. And for a couple of hundred quid, you can buy a machine like this. And for literally a few tens of pounds, you can make hundreds and hundreds of concrete blocks, which solidify in no time in the sun. And part of the work that we did as a charity was to put some money into doing this very thing, because this was designed, we hoped, to help the Sri Lankans get back on their feet. This is another thing that we did see when we were out in March, and this is a vast number of temporary shelters. This road that you see on the other side of that road is the ocean, is the beach in the ocean, and it's beautiful. And these are the villagers and the farm and the fishermen who are going to try and push the boats out and go fishing. Now, the reason they're there is because that's probably where they always lived. The problem is, if you're a Sri Lankan, is that you don't have any title deeds to your home. So if you've got a piece of land, the only way you can prove it is your piece of land is you have to sit on it and live on it. And this was effectively what was happening with these people. And the other problem that they were facing was the infamous 100-meter rule, which had been designed or delineated by the Sri Lankan government. What they decided was that no one would be allowed to rebuild within 100 metres of the high tide mark. Now, that had nothing to do with the tsunami. The tsunami went 3 kilometres inland. But there was, the government felt initially that they wanted to have better rebuilding than there had been before. And that sounds all very laudable. I must say that the cynic in me was much more keen to believe the explanation that there were a great number of luxury hotels who wished to have the land to redevelop. And in fact, the government just a couple of days ago, in fact, indicated that that's precisely what's going to happen in the 100-metre area. And they are saying they're going to create 33,000 jobs. But these people are not going to get the jobs. These people are too poor and they can't get the jobs. At the time, the government were suggesting that what they were going to do was build a model village up to 10 kilometres inland, and that these fishermen were somehow to get 10 kilometres inland to live, leave their boats exposed out on the beach overnight for anybody who or anything that came by, and somehow transport themselves down in the morning in order to go fishing. And it just seemed so impractical that the villagers themselves voted with with their feet and were living in wholly inadequate shelters as a result. One of the things we worried about, and one or two of the medical officers we spoke to in the areas were telling us, there were large areas of stagnant water. Now, most of these were salt water, so they're not terribly mosquito bound, but there was worry that the monsoon would wash that out, make it slightly more desalinated, and that mosquito diseases would become a problem. In fact, in the area we were, dengue fever is an issue, but we subsequently found that there's very little malaria and none of the dreaded Jap B encephalitis, which periodically can be more troublesome in more eastern parts of Sri Lanka. But that was something we were worrying about. We also found that one of our projects was involved with the fact that one or two of the medical officers told us all their fridges had been lost in the tsunami. They had no money to buy new fridges and they weren't immunising their children. So we, in fact, paid for fridges so that they could store their vaccines and begin these programs again. They also immunised the pigs because the pigs are the prime breeding grounds for particularly dengue and possibly Jap B, I think, as well. So they immunise them so if they get bitten, they don't harbour the disease. This is the library at Paralia. Now, this again, not my picture, but soon after the tsunami, showing the damage. This is the only building in the area, as far as I believe, that survived. And this is probably what it looked like shortly afterwards. By the time we got there, it had been transformed into a medical centre. There was a German lad called Oscar and an American nurse called Alison Thompson, more about whom later, who had begun to pioneer this. And there were several people helping them in that. And this is the sort of clientele they had. And as you see, this looks overwhelming in itself, just people turning up to be treated. This is Alison Thompson. She wouldn't remember me I'm going to say quite a lot about her, but she wouldn't remember me because when I was introduced to her, she burst into tears. Well, I hope it's nothing to do with me. I think it was a lot to do with what she was facing that day. And she's a remarkable woman. She worked and lived at the base of the Twin Towers in New York at the time of 9/11. And she spent, as a nurse, and spent a lot of time in the aftermath looking after people and helping them recover. My understanding is she also happened to be in Sri Lanka around the time of the tsunami and found herself drawn to Paralia, where she has been instrumental in setting up the recovery program for a lot of that area and in organizing a superb amount of volunteer medical help. As you see, there's a piece of artwork behind of Alison, which I think is a really uncanny likeness. She, given the fact that she's had this proximity to disaster, she's an amazing person. But if she came and moved in next door to you, I would suggest that you leave. Things seem to happen around her. I want to give you a couple of pieces from Alison's website, and they just for me sort of show the sorts of things that she's faced over the years, and it gives some kind of insight into the stresses that afflict these people on a daily basis. On the one hand, there's the example in the developed New York, where medical care and attention would have been fantastic, and yet the carnage was dreadful. And on the other hand, contrasting that with the tsunami, where even a long time afterwards, August the 9th, a long time after the tsunami, she's still there, and they still have to cope with the fact that for no reason at all, young people still die. Here we see them at work inside the medical centre. And the next picture shows someone else who's in this room tonight. And this is Shoren Datta, who is a gastroenterologist of Glasgow fame. And out there, I met Shoren and his wife, Carolyn. And they had been working in Chennai in India and had moved to Sri Lanka after the tsunami and were working with Alison and in the whole Hikkaduwa area, looking after the people there. We were very fortunate, in fact, to get to know them. They came back to Glasgow, but we were also very happy as a charity that they were able to go back out, and they did a lot of work for us, in particular liaising with Dr. Pereira, our forensic pathologist, and also with one of the hospitals, more of which we'll see in a moment. But I think it would also be nice for me to say as well, from Glasgow to Caring City, thank you also to Dr. Shoren and Dr. Carlin, because we are well aware that a huge number of projects were enacted because of what you did, and we're incredibly grateful to you for what you did. These are king coconuts. I put that in because it was great. They're fantastic things to drink, and you get into them because they take a machete and they hack them to bits in front of you and give them to you to drink. And of course, that's what happens if you miss. In fact, that's it an awful lot better. I'm told that it of course presented hugely infected. I think there's a stitch somewhere there as well, and I, not being a surgeon, I wouldn't even guess at what's at the bottom of that wound, but it in fact healed very, very well. And I'm sorry I don't have the finished article to show you, but it's a very, very good result when it's been healed. One of the problems, of course, of all wounds out there in 40 degrees of heat is that they inevitably turn septic, and you can be and they then, you know, even healthy people can have a long, long protracted recovery from any sort of wound. That's to do with machetes, and this is another insight into what goes on in Sri Lankan society. And one of the interesting things that seems to have happened over the months is that initially the islanders had the typical stunned reaction that anyone would have with a dreadful tragedy, the numbness, the type of grief reaction, and that would go through various phases, the guilt and the anger and whatever. But eventually, they start to resort to type. And resorting to type for Sri Lankans, I think it was Shoran told me, tends to be that they are, and I would agree with this, that they're very friendly, wonderful people, seemingly slow to anger, but when they go, they just seem to ignite. And a situation that at one point seemed very calm can suddenly ignite and become almost in a second or two murderous. And there are tribal rivalries. Another thing that Alison did and Oscar and the people at Paralia was when the Tamil situation reignited, when the Tamils killed the foreign minister of Sri Lanka, they organised a football match between the local Tamils and the other locals, and did a great deal to try to calm the situation, and in fact were very, very effective in that. Sri Lanka, though, gets on with normal life, and despite where they are, they continue to do the normal things, even in the bases of their homes. This is Davy Adams. He's a chief firemaster from Greenock, part of the charity. Some of us in the charity call Davy the camel because he always carries at least 2 months' food in front of him everywhere he goes. And Davy's just helping with the daily routines. And one of the things that was helping towards was the fact that very quickly the schools restarted. One of the things that was interesting was that they restarted schools in tents, but the initial problem was that children didn't seem to want to go, and it was found very quickly that the reason was that they didn't have uniforms, and they were ashamed to go to school without uniforms. So a number of charities pitched in, and suddenly they had uniforms, and they're incredible. They're really very, very clean and happy and well turned out in incredible dust, 42 degrees of heat. We, within a day of getting there, all the Brits, all of us Brits out there, were a disaster. We looked like something the cat had dragged in. And there were these wonderfully turned out people at all times of the day. On the best that we could find out from talking to them about it was that they said that they showered 3 times a day, which puts us in the shade somewhat. This is Dr. Veerasinghe. He's another incredible guy. He runs the Category 3 hospital in Ratchikanda. There are, as you can guess, there are several categories of hospital. And a Category 3 hospital is about the lowest grade that you can get. And he does some basic general practice and minor surgery from this surgery that you're looking at here. But he also has wards, including a medical ward. He's got a surgical and a paediatric ward. He had an obstetric ward, and I'll tell you a bit about that. He's got very basic things. He and his nurses see up to 150 people a day, and he just gets on with being the local guy. One of the interesting things, he had quite a number of drugs that had been given to him by a variety of sources, and we did a little bit of work in trying to understand German to translate some of the names with him. But we also noticed that his BNF was dated 1987. So that despite the fact that he's a very highly trained and a very intelligent guy, he has to work with very basic material. So one of the other things that we did was we tried very hard to meet some of his immediate needs, and perhaps a little more about in the next few slides. He also told me, I've got an interest in medical legal medicine, he said. I thought, whoa, that's interesting. I'm interested in medical legal medicine, I said. But I didn't realise that what he meant was that he likes to dabble in autopsy. And so we actually bought him an autopsy set as well, because, again, he dealt with 160 bodies, nine of whom were foreigners that he shipped away. But the others, in fact, he managed to identify, I think, 142 of them. After the tsunami. But again, still got a smile on his face, but I don't know how many of us, as a GP, if I was running the local cottage hospital, which would be the equivalent, I'm not at all sure what I would do with 160 bodies if they landed on my doorstep tomorrow. Here's his hospital and here are his nurses. Now, I can't remember when I've seen such clean nurses, except maybe in the Victoria Infirmary 20 plus years ago. I called her matron. I don't know if she's the sister or whatever, but the lady with the watch is one of the best turned out and nicest people. And they're a nice bunch of people who get on with their job and who do a lot of work with very poor resources. The patients, mostly the ones that we saw, mostly had asthma-type related diseases at the time, but they have open wards with relatively poor floor areas. At the back out, to the left, you can just see the cats who are there to keep the rats down. And one of the things that Dr. Viasinga was keen to have was the ability to tile his floors and partly up the walls in order to improve cleanliness. And I think we were able to do that. I'm looking over as to whether that happened, or that was certainly one of the things we were interested in doing. Oh, right. Oh, that was the other thing. There were a lot of people around there. Here's his kitchens. I love his kitchens. And here's his food. Now, the reason they're black is because they barbecue everything on open fires. And his food, I thought, was the best hospital food I have seen anywhere. Seriously. It was beautifully done. It was freshly prepared. It was nicely spiced. And boy, it would have been nice to have stayed for lunch, wouldn't it? Despite the surroundings, what you see is not necessarily what is actually happening. This is his maternity ward. It's a bit of a sad tale. Dr. Viasinga had worked in a unit where he did 100 deliveries a month. So he's an experienced obstetrician, general practitioner. And his unit had at one stage had about 64 deliveries a year, had fallen to about 16 by the time the tsunami came. And he then stored 160 bodies in here so that his anticipated deliveries in the next year were going to be zero because of the bad spirits that were still inhabiting his wards, according to the locals. Plus the fact there was a local consultant unit about 30 minutes down the road which had opened, and quite reasonably a lot of people were deciding that was a much more appropriate place to go and have your baby. One of the interesting things that happened was, as I understand it, a German charity arrived, went above. Dr. Viasinga had no doubts that he didn't need a new obstetrics ward. They went above him and went and spoke to his divisional medical officer, and he's now getting a new obstetrics ward, which is being completely built for him, a new build. And perhaps I might suggest that might be another form of bad charity, where without really listening to what's required, something is done. However, that's his ambulance. The sad thing is, it's a very useful ambulance. It's got a trolley in it. I think it's got some oxygen, and you can move people around in it quite quickly. He only transfers people from his hospital to the bigger hospital in Gaul with it. If somebody outside the hospital gate falls down and breaks their leg, the ambulance isn't used. And this made us think of another potential project, which we're still investigating. I'm not sure if it will happen, whereby we might station one of these with the local police and have it used as an ambulance to help the area. One of the great problems of the area is the traffic. The traffic is absolutely mental, and there are quite frequently quite serious traffic accidents. And the result of that is that quite often people lie seriously injured and dying as a result of it. Again, what I thought I picked up from this was that the Sri Lankans are not terribly keen to become involved with people who might die. Someone said that might be a Buddhist thing because they don't like being involved with death. But one way or another, if you get injured and you're lying at the side of the road, the tales I heard were that it was you had to hope that a European came along, because otherwise you were going to probably lie there for some time. And there are a number of tales from the medical people we spoke to out there of very difficult situations when they had to pick people up and try and transport them to hospitals from road accidents. And it would be great, and one of our aims is still to try to have our friends in the police trained up in such a way that they can at least operate this in a rudimentary way, and that will undoubtedly save lives in a kind of scoop and lift operation. He's a lovely wee man. Another project. This is an 82-year-old rice farmer, and that's his paddy field. Obviously, it's in the dry season, but it's been completely ruined by salt water. He's 3 kilometres inland, and the tsunami washed in and killed his rice. We found that for £40, we could completely replant his 5 acres, and we also found that there were a huge number of farmers all around him, and we replanted all of those, or at least we bought seed. What we did was we took him to the wholesaler, and he struck the deal, and we paid the money. Some of our folks were back in June and July after monsoon, and unfortunately, he hoped that that would wash out the salt from his fields, and unfortunately, the rice crop had failed. But, farmers are canny people. He had, in fact, only planted half his rice seed, and he'd kept half behind. So in the monsoon that's just probably finishing around now, he was hoping in the aftermath of that to have another go and watch this space, as they say. And if it doesn't work, then we'll buy more seed and we'll plant him out again next year. He can feed himself and 5 families, and every other farmer in the area can do this. And this was, we felt, very worthwhile, because what it was actually doing was beginning a regenerative process. He only needs rice seed once. Once he's done it once, he harvests, and he's got seed for the next one, so that he's self-perpetuating once he gets going, and this seemed to us very worthwhile. He's a lovely man, and I tell you, back-breaking work in 40 degrees when you're 82, boy oh boy, that's good going. These are the fishermen's boats, and it was just to remind me that, again, another project was the rebuilding of the boats, and we did get involved with that, and this is one of the boatyards where they are in the process of doing just that. They're beautifully painted, highly coloured, and in fact, hundreds of the local fishermen have been helped by a variety of charities to get back in the water and get going. This is Southern Sri Lanka's only fire engine. It is based in Galle, and it serves 400,000 people. Most of the hoses have been damaged in the tsunami. We managed to arrange. We met a whole bunch of Italian firefighters out in Galle, and they're going to rebuild the fire station. And Strathclyde Fire Brigade have donated 3 ex-use but very modern fire appliances to go out. The Italian fire engines don't fit the couplings in Sri Lanka, which are, of course, British from the old days, so that it's wonderful our British fire engines and the Italians will get together. The Italian firefighters were an amazing bunch of people, highly nice long hair, lots of fancy clothes and a real swagger, and lots of Italian and all the gesticulations, just as you might imagine. But so far they've fronted up, and the plans are going ahead for the fire station. The police were very important people to talk to as well. There is corruption in the Sri Lankan police. They're very keen, they're very happy to admit it. But the truth of the matter is there's also a great deal of a application and a willingness to engage in the problems that they face. And one of the problems that they face is that they have no transport. And Chief Inspector Lee Wilson of Strathclyde's finest over there went and did a deal on 2 motorbikes for them, which I think must have absolutely bankrupted the wee man who sold them. Chandra over on the far left is the chief of police in the Hikkaduwa area, and He said to Lee at one point during the negotiations, that's it, that's the best deal you can possibly get. And I think Lee, taking that as a red rag to a bull, then got the deal about half as much again, helmets, leathers and everything else thrown in. And the wee man, I think, was just begging him to leave the shop by the end of it. He's a very, very hard man to say no to. He also arranged for about 50 of these push bikes to go out along with ex-Strathclyde bibs. And the other thing he did was he sent out a lot of mobile phones that were not used in this country. We rechipped them for Sri Lanka, and the police can now talk to each other. It's amazing that when you do very, very simple things like that, you suddenly make the police more effective. And the police are a very, very important bunch of people. He's also arranging for Chandra to come to a Tully Allen Police Academy in order that they can maintain the connection and try to help train him as a better leader and try and improve the quality of the police. By doing that, there's a chance that they will be more effective, and also we're hoping to be able to get involved with an early warning system. This, in fact, is an early warning system that Alison Thompson and friends have organised at Paralia, and there's talk, the King City Charity are hoping to use some old Second World War sirens to begin to set these up along the coast. The reason for this is that the residents are naturally very much happier when they have some sort of warning as to what might happen, even if the overall risk is low. It nevertheless is a very useful thing and helps. As I was saying, Lee's a great guy. We had to go and get money one day. It was a Sunday, and I suppose being Brits, we thought, oh, everything will be closed on a Sunday. Of course, Sundays don't operate in Sri Lanka necessarily, but we were going, and this is Chandra and his deputy chief, and Lee said we need to go and change some money for the charity to because we were going to buy fridges, I think. And so he said, do you know anywhere we can go? And he took us around the back streets to this money changer. And we jumped out the van, and there was a 6'5" policeman. There was me. There was a chief of police of Hikkaduwa and the deputy chief of police of Hikkaduwa. I've never seen a more worried man behind the glass as we moved up. And Lee, in his booming Scots voice, said, we want to change some English pounds, he said. What's the rate? Now, the rate, I should explain, is about 176 or so, 176 rupees to the pound. And the wee man blurted out, 195, he said. and it's the best rate we've ever had, actually. So if you're ever in Sri Lanka and you see a big old policeman, take him to the money changer. There were lots of little projects, and this is one of those. These two wee lads are deaf. They've been deaf since birth. And we came across them, and we felt that it wasn't really something we could walk away from. And what had happened was they'd had rudimentary hearing aids, but they needed more workup, and they needed to be considered for cochlear implants. So we had just a little bit of fun having a wee look after them. And what we've managed to do is put them back in. We've managed to connect them back into the machinery of being looked after. They've got their hearing aids again, which aren't particularly working, and we're still working towards the concept that one day we may be able to get them cochlear implants, although they may have to go to India for that, but that's still on the melting pot. A couple of weeks ago I would have said this wee lass has, I don't know if anyone fancies giving us a diagnosis, any ENT specialists or... I'm told it's probably a cystic hygroma, although Archie Bain, ex of the Vic, told me that he thought it could also be a branchial cyst. But anyway, I would have said this wee lass, but a couple of weeks ago, Neil Wilkinson, one of our workers out there, said that he went along at nappy changing time, and it's this wee lad has got a cystic hygroma. And in fact, Neil has raised the money, and this is going to be fixed. These are sporadic things, but when you come across them, it's very difficult to walk away. Our final main project is Raqqa Institutional Complex. We were alerted to this by the local police chief in Gaul, who is the closest man to God I've ever met. He exists in an office with about 20 people simply waiting at the far end of the office for him to simply wag his finger. And it was only when I arrived late at the meeting to meet him, and it was only when I got in there that I realised that every single person in that room was not wearing their shoes. And the only two people wearing shoes in the room was the chief of police and me. So I hid my feet way under the table and tried to sneak out, covered by about 20 other people, so that he didn't realise. But bottom line is, this is an interesting place. This is where they take, prior to the tsunami, this is where they took their children who were victims of abuse, sexual or physical abuse. What happens is that they throw the father or the perpetrator in jail, and the family descend into even more grinding poverty because there's no breadwinner. So they would take them here, and they would give them some overnight or respite care of sorts, and they would put them in a room where they played them. They actually had a video recorder and a TV, and they were playing them Sri Lankan videos. And we asked, what's on the video? And it was explained to us that what these children were seeing was a video that was telling them how lucky they were. And when you see the sorts of place that it was kind of bare and rudimentary. This is one of the bathrooms in the place. It's fine, but it's not particularly great. It's got a wee vanity unit. This is the only child-friendly bit of the bit that we found in the place. The sad thing is, you'd have to be a child of about 6'3" in order to be able to use it. So the other thing that I forgot to say was, after the tsunami, in addition to the abused victims that they had, they then had another 800 orphans to look after. And so Raqqa House had become a major, major issue for them. So we've been quite involved in its refurbishment. And as you see, things are starting to get a bit better. That was the kitchen in Raqqa House. And although still of the same nature, it's very much cleaner and better from that point of view. So what we've been able to do with Raqqa, and what we're doing in an ongoing way now, is we've put a lot of funding in. We're going to pay for two teachers to work there from Britain over the next 3 years. And the idea is that what we're hoping to do is, we're actually hoping to educate the educators, if you like. What they're going to do is bring on a whole tranche of Sri Lankan teachers in order to help these children. We also did things that we went out and we, this shows what monsoon's like a wee bit. When it rains, it's just like the shower going on. But you can see that they're painting some murals. And we did a number of sort of things to tart the place up. We went out and bought a whole lot of Disney videos, and the children suddenly became an awful lot happier. And Raqqa House is a nice place for them to go to now. The other thing that happens is that when in Raqqa House, they give them 1,000 rupees a month if for these children that they're looking after. Now, with another 800 orphans, that's a lot of money. It's about a fiver a month, but it keeps them off the breadline with no breadwinner. So what we've been able to do is undertake to underwrite quite a substantial amount of that, and we're going to be supplying quite a lot of the money that will help with that. And the other thing I'd like to get going at Sri Lanka, going back to my love of cricket, is I'm hoping to get out there and get a lot of cricket equipment out and start them all playing cricket again. Cricket and volleyball are the main sports of Sri Lanka, as far as I can see. Again, if there are any nationalists here, if we get them playing cricket, then undoubtedly they'll be beating England at cricket as well. Here's an interesting guy. Oh, gee, I'd like to tell you that just sort of in the final rundown in this presentation. This guy is called Sebastian Plues. He's a German from Berlin, and he ran a radio show out there. He's about late 20s, Sebastian. He has the most perfect English you can imagine. He went out there, started working at Peralia, decided that wasn't enough, jumped into one of the local tuk-tuks, the wee things that putt-putt around, formed himself into a local ambulance and went around looking after people. That wasn't enough after that, so he went around and started digging toilets and making toilets for the locals, rebuilding. He's got a great way of doing it. He went to one of the villages and said, they were all sitting around stunned, and he said to them, look, he said, I'll pay you the local average wage, which is about £1.90 a day. I'll pay you that if I'll give you some materials, and if you've rebuilt the boat by when I come back next week, I'll pay you for nets. And he would do it in that way. And if they don't do it, he gets a stick and he kind of prods them and tells them to do it. He's a lovely, delightful guy. Very little of the Teutonic about him, but when he needs to, he's very good at getting them going. The other thing he's set up in a place called Busa is he's been involved in a local orphanage. He's got an IT suite going, and he's got a lot of teaching going on and education. He is a really remarkable guy. To be honest, On this occasion, we were sitting in the evening, and he just said to me, he'd been talking to me about projects he was interested in, and then he said, over a pot of tea, it was amazing for me to spend an evening with a pot of tea, but there you have it. And he said, what literature do you like? And I said, oh, Sebastian, the only German literature I can think of is All Quiet in the Western Front. He said, no, English stuff. So I found Cirilli. I thought, I better try and impress him. And I thought of what I did in sixth year at Scothar. I said, have you ever heard of T.S. Eliot? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, The Wasteland. And so Cirilli, we found ourselves discussing The Wasteland and Death by Water. Now, maybe some of you have read it, maybe haven't, but I thought that this was a stunning, stunning poem to be sitting in Sri Lanka, having had a tsunami. And it struck me that this is an awful lot about the way we live our lives. Here we have this young man, Phlebas the Phoenician, thought he knew everything that was going on in his life. He was out there in his boat running his businesses, and the storm hit him, and he's under the sea. And it really doesn't matter how much you think you're in control and how much you look to see which way the wind's blowing. Just remember that one day you can be like Phlebas, as handsome and tall as you. And I kind of hate Sebastian. I mean, he looks like that. He does all these things. He's bilingual, and he knows all about T.S. Eliot. There's nothing the guy can't do. It's incredible. Finally, somebody said, a lot of what we're doing here is a sticking plaster on a cancer. The need is vast. The need is vast. It's huge. You can't ever change the way these people live their lives. Their lives are always going to be on a different level of need. I don't know, some of you may know in educational, there's a concept known as Maslow's Pyramid of Needs. I should have brought a slide of it. But it's really about, it attempts to define human needs, and it's a triangular or pyramid shape. And there's this pyramid shape, okay, Maslow's Pyramid. And on the bottom rung of it are the very basic things we need for life. And these are things like warmth, food, and water. And if we have those, we can live. And on the next run, we might need shelter, and we might need some other basic things that will help us to live. And as you go further up, you might get love, and somewhere up at the top, you might get opera or something like that. But, you know, you can imagine how that goes up. Now, the simple fact is that in Sri Lanka, they're living on, particularly after tsunami, on the very bottom rung very often. And a lot of what we are doing could never, never address the huge amounts of need in terms of warmth and shelter. But, you know, it was nice just sometimes to give a wee girl a bag and another couple for her friends and brothers, sisters. And it was essential to give them cooking equipment. And we did quite a lot of that. And that's not going to change the world, but it will change these people's lives. And if that's a sticking plaster on a cancer, then I think that's fair enough. I think that's something we've got to live with. Another piece of T.S. Eliot, the very end of The Wasteland, the epic poem, he comes up with a piece of Sanskrit, Data Dayadvam Damyata, and it stands for give, sympathise, control. Now, I think that really basically what medical charity work, if you like, is about, or any of this is about giving, and everybody here, I'm certain, has given in their time. The people who went there and who were working there and who are still working there quite clearly gave in a way that is so much different than the way that most of us do. Some of the people I've told you about. Dayadvam, sympathise, doesn't actually mean to sympathise in the sort of being sad for way. I think it means more to understand. And I think understanding the type of people that you look after, understanding the fact that they're not saints. There's still internecine rivalry. There are still problems. And you can't do everything in life. And finally, control. One of the things that I'll always remember about going out there and having a discussion with Sebastian is that you might think that you're in control of your life, and you might think that you know what you're going to do tomorrow. But on Christmas Day, the end of Christmas Day last year, Morag woke me up from my slumber in the chair, as is my normal way on the evening of Christmas, after a good meal, probably a couple more glasses of wine than I should have. And I thought that Boxing Day would be the same as Boxing Day had always been. and of course it wasn't. And that was in a tiny way. These people in Sri Lanka, they thought that they would get up and do their, and had control of their lives in the way that they had always been, and of course it was anything but. So give, sympathise, control strikes me as being things that it's often worth pondering. That was some of the people in Sri Lanka. The ones to perhaps mention, David Heyman of Spirit Aid, the actor, who his crowd went out and did a lot of work with young children, helping them come to terms with the problems they'd faced. MC, one of our workers in Sri Lanka, the girl in the front, she had worked there for a long time and did a huge amount of work in terms of logistics. And a lot of what we did and what other people have done couldn't have been done without her input. And a nice wee guy on the end there, the Venerable Rawatha, the top Buddhist monk from Scotland. He comes from Maryhill, and the amount of work he did was phenomenal. These people were part of the team. Sri Lanka remains and always will do a beautiful place to go to. Please go back if you've been before. Please go if you've not been. It's ready for visiting. If you go, try and put some money into the local economy. Try and find a way of not doing it to the Hilton Hotel. Just enjoy it if you go. I hope this has been interesting. It's really very much a mishmash, as I said at the beginning, of the people, the places, and the country of Sri Lanka. A little bit about what we did, but the place is now recovering. I hope it will continue to recover, and I hope that you will go there one day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David, for an inspiring talk about, and entertaining talk about creative response to disaster. Are you willing to take questions?
Of course, yeah. If I'm able, I will. Yes, thank you.
Why did the government take so long to extract the original?
I think probably a number of reasons, actually. I think the original... I think they were overwhelmed originally. Colombo's an interesting place. It's got a faded Raj-like look about it. There's a number of buildings that were built when the British were there, which are starting to crumble. When we were there, there was a rumour that the President and the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka didn't get on, and that the government was absolutely hung on that. And in fact, I believe that the Prime Minister has now become President. There was a Tamil situation. Colombo was an interesting place to walk along. If you walk along the seafront, there are sandbag emplacements everywhere near the government buildings. There was one place where we walked. Lee Wilson, I made a mistake of going for a walk with him. The policeman, really bad idea, because he wanted to go and speak to all the police in Sri Lanka. And there were a whole bunch of them behind a machine gun emplacement, and he strode up to them. And as we were chatting, I looked around, and way up in just what looked like apartment blocks, there were just simple... There were guys in what appeared to be relatively civilian clothes with submachine guns just sitting, leaning against the walls. And I presume they were there because if there was some kind of terrorist attack, they were going to jump out and shoot people. But it didn't feel a very nice place to be. So I think they're not particularly well organised, and perhaps that was the reason.
What's the main source of funding for the charity you've been
keeping? The truth of the matter is Glasgow King City Charity is what's called a goods and kind charity mostly. It's been involved for about six years. It's been involved in going to parts of the world that have need, but mostly what they've done is they have collected things like clothing, bedding, tents, whatever. And they have a warehouse in Lawmoor Road in Dixon's Blazes. They parcel them up, they container them out, and they take them out. They've got ongoing projects in Africa and South Africa and in Malawi at the moment, helping build a hospital out there. And mostly they ship things out. It's in the more recent past that they've started getting money, and that has helped us to both move people around and also buy things like equipment. Sean and Carlin, actually, when they were out in June again, bought quite a lot of equipment for the hospital in Arachi Kanda, and it was good to be able to do that and get it out. Because the other thing is that it costs money to ship things out, and although we bully the shippers and often get it for free, we make nice requests of them. We often get it for free. Simple fact is that it's often much cheaper to buy out there if you can and have the stuff. The East Pakistan problem is very much along those lines. What we've tended to do we've managed to raise about £120,000, and the plan is to get that out there, because you can buy the stuff out there and use it, and it's much cheaper to buy out there than to take it here and ship.
Am I the only person who's just a little surprised that it's considered worthwhile to dig up all the mass graves to identify the bodies in terms of priorities? Could you not just accept that there are mass casualties and it's not possible to identify them all?
I don't know if Sean or Carlin, from your chats with Cliff, if you've any ideas about why that was perhaps happening.
I don't know if they actually finally went ahead with that. It was something that was being discussed at the time we were
right.
here. And again, we didn't really see why it was going to be a worthwhile pursuit.
I wondered if some of it might be to do with the fact that not all the mass graves were really very deep, and that some of them were quite shallow.
Even the ones soon came that they were very shallow graves and they were going to get washed up. So part of the reason was that they were going to dig them up so they could to relocate them or cremate them, etc.
From the point of view of future donations, do you think money is... somebody like me should give money to a small charity like yours or to the big charity which is advertised in television, the thing which is supposed to include all the big charities?
Depends what you want to do, I think, is the answer. The big charities have now been able to build quite large areas, and they established camps and they looked after, so that by the time they were able to be effective, they were able to build quite large numbers of buildings. And they, of course, have got that money, and they're going to be continuing to use that money. We weren't there any faster than the big charities, so small charities aren't necessarily any faster. I think we probably act on a different level. The big charities, we found in the first few months, seemed to be stymied, embroiled in talks with government. The Prime Minister of Sri Lanka is said to have come down, and in a blaze of cameras on a Saturday, come down to the Hikkaduwa region and announced that he was going to make a whole lot of land in the 100-metre zone available for temporary housing. The Monday afterwards, it said that a little note was sent back down saying, I've changed my mind. So that the cameras recorded that he had said it was going to happen, and he then took it back. And the big charities were embroiled in that. We are no more prone to get it right than anyone else. And as I say, some of what we did was sticking plasters on cancers. But the things that we are doing that we think are useful is, from our point of view, and it's only people I can talk for, because of our links with police forces and fire brigade, and even our medical links, we can actually do specific things that will make a specific difference. And we have learned a lot. We do learn a lot. And we're trying our hardest to be sensitive to what people are telling us. So we would do our very best not to be involved in the rebuild of the next maternity ward, for example, in Arachi Kanda, or that sort of thing. Whereas other charities with money tend to find that they rush in, and these sorts of mistakes can happen. It's not an answer. You have to decide. You really have to make up your own mind, I'm afraid.
I think there's definitely a role for both, because they do, the larger charities, and the smaller charities definitely operate on different levels. I would say, from a slightly cynical point of view, having been there, the large charities spend a lot of time putting up signs and advertising themselves in the area.
They all have brand new 4x4 Jeeps as well.
Yeah, by top of the range 4x4
Red Cross. And,
the top dogs staying in very expensive hotels, $300 a night and things. So a lot of that going on.
I think 40% of the money you give to a large charity goes in administrative fees, which is necessary because they're going to do more long-term work. but smaller charities can be very effective in the short term. But quite a lot of the areas that were being looked after by small charities had to hand over to the larger charities in the long run.
And their headquarters are all in London, of course, as well, which isn't cheap.
Does the political situation with the Tamils impinge at all? Or is it holding back economic development? Or?
Again, I've been sitting...
Not in this
shows.
Area, but certainly there's a lot of problems on the East Coast.
Yes. And I'm wondering if it was holding back overall development. Or is it like the south of Ireland? And really the north of Ireland is sort of far away and another country.
Certainly the East Coast was not as well served in terms of the larger charities. There weren't so many smaller charities there because small charities tended to go to, these are sort of more tourist areas that were and nearby tourist areas that the smaller charities went to. Some started to go to the East Coast, but there was a lot of difficulties with the Tamils. In fact, when we were initially going to go out there, it wasn't this area we were going to go to. We'd been in India and we knew a bit of Tamil, so we thought we'd be best served going to the Tamil area. But the charity that we had... or weren't even a charity, it was just a group of doctors from the UK who were Sri Lankan origin, and there'd been four people assassinated in the area, so we decided, well, we want to help out, but we don't want to go to that area anymore, and they pulled out. So it was very difficult working in those areas, and they didn't get as good a service, and that's been well advertised, I think, on the news as well.
It seemed, around the time we were out in March, it seemed like the government and the Tamils were... all the bets were off. They'd sort of cozied up to each other. It seemed that the Tamils were hoping that the government were going to begin to help out there. Because, in fact, in Trincomalee, I think they had something like a quarter of a million displaced people round the corner and up the east side. It was much worse, some of the devastation. But what seemed to happen over time was that partly because the government were stymied, they just simply couldn't act. They were frozen because of internecine fighting, but also possibly because of old-fashioned rivalries and scores. They didn't really front up and help the Tamils, and I think that resulted in the foreign minister being assassinated by the Tamils in about June, July time or something like that. So it's all broken down again from what one can hear.
You mentioned Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Freedom from bombs and bullets would be kind of below the first one on that one.
Yeah, well, and they haven't achieved that. And to be fair, your average fisherman probably isn't at risk of a bomb or a bullet. In Hikkaduwa is not at risk of a Tamil bomb or bullet particularly, but he is at risk of the guy from the tribe down the road coming and hacking him to bits. I know that in medical societies we love seeing the gory pictures, but I couldn't lay my hands on them. But I have seen them, and they're very unattractive. What machetes do.
So funny then, Russ,
you're putting sticky plasters on cancer. How do you presumably have to make very hard choices as to what you actually tackle? I imagine that you must come away worrying about the things that you wish you could have done, and.
I'd love to hear Sean and Carlin's. From a charity point of view, there were things that we could do and couldn't do. There were also things that we started doing and realised we were wrong, and that's about the best you can say with your hand on your heart is you try and keep your antennae open and stay as sensitive as you can. I personally have tried to identify people and places that need support and then push the support at it. I still feel guilty about one or two people I saw out there that I wasn't able to help as much as I'd like to, but having thought about it, I've justified that to myself by thinking that I didn't go there to change their world. I went there because I hoped that we could set something up that could keep running. And that was the reason. But you must feel you must feel worse because you spent time treating these people a lot out there.
It's almost impossible to decide who to help out, and that was one of our big dilemmas. Obviously, we're helping out in terms that we're there on the ground in a medical sense, but we'd also wanted to help people start up businesses again, etc. And for example, Alison had great problems because running the medical centre, a lot of people donated money, but she also had her own money, and she was using that money to help some of the villagers. But the villagers didn't see the, and this is obviously wrong of her to do that, but she was getting death threats because they thought she had millions and millions of pounds apparently she'd been given. That's what the villagers thought, which wasn't the case, and was just giving it out to people who weren't necessarily deserving it, and there was a lot of problems within the village created with that. So we didn't give money specifically to anybody that we were helping. The only people we gave money to were tips to our translators, and trying to help out some businesses that were, we thought were worthwhile, and either through people that we knew or through other charities that we knew other people needed to get back on their feet again, their businesses started again. But it's impossible to help everybody. It's really difficult.
I think I can talk from here. People will probably hear me. David, I got the impression that you could have gone on for at least another hour. There's obviously an element of reminiscence from an experience like that that you've had, and an impressive amount that you've covered. I mean, the number of projects that you talked about. You didn't actually tell us how long you'd been there, but obviously, whatever period of time it was, you crammed in a lot. And I think Philip said it was obviously it's a depressing. The aftermath of the tsunami is a disaster and depressing, but you've also shown us the optimism of the people you met and the way that people react. And I suppose what it brings out in some people, and so there's been a kind of strand of optimism through what you've said, as well as the inevitable disaster of the tsunami itself. I think the other area of interest that you've touched on is this question of direct connection with charity. And the sort of links one can have, which I've had similar experiences of in the past, and which raise this question of how one tries to help and to what extent the direct links can be useful. And as you said in reply, there isn't a straight answer to that question, but it's certainly a very interesting one. I think we've all had a fascinating insight into what's been going on in Sri Lanka. We are all aware of it, but it's been a very interesting evening to hear about it, and I guess people will want to hear more. You obviously want to keep up your contacts, so before I just ask Evan to thank you, I'll just point out that you can keep your contact with Sri Lanka by travelling to Birmingham in May on the 25th. The first test starts at Edgbaston between England and Sri Lanka, so put that in your diary. But on that note, I'd like to obviously get Evan to thank you very much. Having given us a presidential address only 2 years ago, coming back and putting in the effort to give us an evening of your experience in Sri Lanka. Thank you very much indeed.
You have been listening to a programme in the lecture series from the 161st session of the Glasgow Southern Medical Society. For more information and links to Alison Thompson's diary, T.S. Eliot, and Maslow's Pyramid, go to the Society's website at www.gsms.org.uk. We welcome comments about the lecture. Music is by Shiva in Exile and can be found at magnatune.com.